This weekend is a huge weekend for the Mets as 40th anniversary of the 1986 World Series team. Everybody's in town, and I am lucky enough and honored to be speaking to my favorite ball player as a kid. This is the reason why I played third base. This is the reason why I wore the number 20. This is the reason why I tried to switch hit. I didn't last very long, but I tried. Howard Johnson, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for the time.
Yeah, Pete, great to see you. I appreciate all those comments. That's cool. You always wonder if some kid's going to try to top you, you know, when you're a player.
And
the guy. You're the guy.
I'm the guy. I'm sorry. I wasn't very successful at it. I tried. I did my hardest. But first, before anything, Howard, I just want to ask you, you know, you were in the spotlight or your family was in the spotlight a few years ago. Your grandson had an accident.
Yeah.
And I just want to know, how's he doing? Last time I saw, he was hitting the ball. He was looking fantastic. How is he doing, Howard?
Well, thanks for asking about Tanner. He's doing much better. He's lost a third of his foot, so it's a challenge for him, but he's able to get by right now because he's still a young kid. He's learned how to adapt, you know, to not having his toes and stuff. So, you know, there's going to be hiccups, I think, down the road as his foot continues to try to grow bones and whatnot. So there's going to be some things that have to be done, but right now he's doing everything normal and he's going to be here this weekend.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, we're looking forward to seeing him there. We're looking forward to seeing you there as well. And I believe, is there charities too that you could donate or give me a little bit about that?
Well, they had a GoFundMe page. I don't know if that's still going on or not, but we have our own foundation we started called the 20 Foundation. And we're basically helping kids, special needs, kids with handicaps, kids that need any kind of help for school or whatever, underprivileged, underserved kids, families like that. So that's our target audience. And if people want to donate to it, they can always go to the 20foundation.org.
20foundation.org. Yep. Don't forget it. That's awesome. I know plenty of people, my wife included, who works in special needs. It is, you know, unfortunately at times it's a growing industry, but I mean, the fact that so many people are out there understand it and are helping, and it's all different levels. So I'm happy to hear that Tanner's doing well.
Yeah. It's tough on families. I mean, when you have special needs, there's a lot of things that have to be taken care of. Sometimes it's severe, sometimes it isn't, but there's always some kind of sacrifice that people have to make. And if we can help them, you know, ease that a little bit, we want to do it.
Well, let's get into the baseball part of it, your career, because not everybody knows your career. Everyone knows everything. Everyone knows 1986. Everyone knows you leading the league in home runs with the Mets and leading the league in RBIs. But not everybody knows that you came up as a 21-year-old with the Detroit Tigers and won a World Series in 1984. Tell me about that experience, about being on a team with Sparky Anderson and winning a World Series that early in your career.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I got to the big leagues with Detroit, when I walked into that locker room in spring training that first year in 1982, I was amazed at how great the players were. I mean, we had some really, really talented players. I got to watch Kirk Gibson, Alan Trammell, Lou Whitaker, gosh, man, there were so many guys, Chet Lemon. I mean, these guys, Lance Parrish, these guys are like tremendous. Jack Morris on the mound, forget about it, you know? So there's, you know, as a young player, you just want to watch and learn from the best. And if those guys have something that I can learn from, you know, if they approach an at bat a certain way or, you know, whatever, defensively, whatever, if I can grab something from them, that's going to make me better as a player. I learned that a long time ago. If you want to be around the best, you got to be the best. You got to hang around them. So I used to take ground balls behind Alan Trammell, just watching him, his footwork and everything. And I learned so much just doing that and just talking to them. And you start to learn little things about the game that are going to help you. And obviously there's things that they would say to me that I didn't really understand yet, that you have to learn how to hit other pitches. You know, I was a good fastball hitter, always have been. And they start to throw me breaking balls or changeups and stuff. I didn't really know how to handle that. And they said, you're going to have to learn how to do that. I never understood that. It took me about 5 years to figure that out.
What's the difference? I mean, you in 1982 coming up and hitting the fastball, what was the speed at that point in time? We always talk about the difference in speed in a game today. Like today, you got Mizorowski throwing 105. What do you think people were leveling out at or topping out at in front of you? And like that you were still being able to hit a fastball. What were they topping out at?
Well, they didn't really run the radar guns out there like they do now. They have everything on the scoreboards. But, you know, we knew guys were throwing in the low to mid-90s. That's their velo was good. It was legit. And, you know, you learn how to hit fastball early on in the minor leagues. That's the first thing they find out, if you can hit a fastball. And in the big leagues, it's the same way. So those guys are pumping in there pretty good. But the big difference between the game today and the game, you know, in my time, you know, 40 years ago, is that there's more hard throwers than there were back then. There's more now on a team's rotation and in the bullpen. But pitchers back then had to have second and third pitches that they could go to and command. And so you got to see a lot of variety with fastball and then a good, really good changeup, good breaking ball. These guys in a good split, these guys could put it wherever they wanted. And that's the difference between, you know, the minor leagues and the big leagues. In the big leagues, your pitching staff is full of guys that can control pitches and they're going to pitch to the hitter's weakness. Back then, that's what most guys did. There was a different style of pitching. You'd see some guys that didn't throw that hard at all, but they could really make the ball move in or out, and they could take change speeds and take a little bit off here and there, add a little bit here and there. And that was the difference. So you had to learn how to hit like a variety of speeds in one at bat. And that's not always easy. You know, when you face a guy that can move the ball and put it in certain places, it's not the easiest thing in the world to hit.
No, I can't imagine. I can't hit a fastball. I can't hit anything. But I can't imagine a guy. It doesn't make a difference how fast you're throwing. If there's a ton of movement, forget about it. But let's take it through. So you win a championship with the Tigers in 84. The year prior in 83, the Mets are one of the worst teams in the league. I think they had 60-something wins. All of a sudden, after 84, you get traded to that Mets team, which was climbing. They had a 90-something win season in 84. Take me through the emotions of that trade from the Tigers to the Mets and your outlook at that moment.
Wow, that's a good question, Pete. So I remember talking to Bill LaJoie, who was our general manager. I talked to him maybe a month before the winter meetings. This is in December when I got traded. And I had talked to Bill earlier. My wife and I wanted to buy a house in Detroit. And you know what they always say, if you buy a house, you know, you're going to get traded. So I talked to Bill. I asked him, said, hey, am I going to be traded? My wife and I want to buy a house. You know, what do you think? He goes, Howard, we're not going to trade you. He told, so what do I do? I put $15,000 down on a house in Michigan, in Detroit, and all excited about coming back the next year and stuff, and get this phone call December 7th, 1984.
Yeah.
And it was Bill LaJoie, and he's like, it was like 8 o'clock in the morning. And he said, he goes, Howard, we traded you this morning. And I'm like, really? First thing I thought about was that's 15 grand gone. And back then that was a lot of money, you know?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
But he was like, Sparky's just not going to play the way that we feel like he should be played. And, you know, we really need to get a starting pitcher. They can give us innings, and you were the guy that they wanted. And so that was, that's how the trade went down. And the first thing I asked him was, okay, who am I going to? And he said, the New York Mets. I go, okay, I got you. I'm good with that. I knew the team was on the rise. I was always kind of a National League fan, watching the Phillies in spring training. You know, I grew up in Clearwater, so I got to see them play a lot. National League games on TV. You know, it just seemed to be a little more free-flowing with AstroTurf and just a lot of running and the pitcher hitting. So there's a lot of things going on, and I kind of liked that style of baseball. And so when I got traded to the Mets, I felt like I was going to a place that could really find my footing and plant roots.
Well, and who knew what was to come? I mean, did you feel that? Like, all of a sudden, you get traded for, the next thing you know, the Mets are trading away Hubie Brooks for Gary Carter, which is another significant trade. I mean, did you feel that the Mets, I mean, you said you looked from afar, you kind of were paying, you're a National League guy, but did you think that you were leaving the Tigers, who just won a World Series? Did you see that with the Mets? Did you really think that they were a World Series contender?
Well, once we got Carter, I mean, he was a guy that I think he came over like a week later or something like that. And when he got that, when he came over, I knew at that point, I said, this team is like being built to win a championship. I felt it because we had Dwight Gooden, you had Ron Darling, you had a bullpen with Orozco and Roger McDowell. I remember my first spring training with the Mets, seeing these guys actually performing and doing their thing, and seeing the players that they had in the system, guys like Kevin Mitchell. I mean, these guys are, you know, Backman, Tuffel came over the next year, but when all those pieces started to happen, Keith Hernandez, I mean, you could see it. There was a team that was destined to reach a level that could compete for a championship. And so when I got over there, I felt like, okay, well, I've done this before, and I just want to be a part of it. You know, whatever Davey wanted to do with me, I was all for it. So he had a plan and I was all in. And so it's just fun to watch that team kind of grow over the, you know, the days and weeks leading up to spring training, and then, you know, spring training and then going into the season. So we had a good team, and we knew we were close, and we almost got there in 85.
Take me through the difference between Sparky Anderson and David Johnson, because if I'm correct, they're very opposite in styles. So take me through Sparky Anderson, who you win a World Series with in 1984, and then 2 years later, Davey Johnson.
Well, Sparky was an older guy, had the big red machine back in the 70s. He had done a good job with Detroit coming over there. The players were really good, though. Whitaker, Trammell, Gibson, Parrish. You had up the middle, you were strong, and then Chet Lemon. So you had all the pieces defensively to add, and they added Darrell Evans going into the 84 season. So we added veteran leadership and guys that could really play. Sparky was a very old school type manager, loved the older players, the veteran players. He had a bad reputation of, you know, playing around with young players a little bit too much, moving them around and just not really communicating well. I learned that the hard way, unfortunately. I did everything Sparky and the coaches asked. I love Sparky to death, but I think it wasn't the best fit for me. But I was part of a team that was trying to win, and I wanted to be a part of that. And I would do whatever they said. I never gave any kind of blowback or nothing. So I did all of it. Going to the Mets now, Davey Johnson is probably the opposite. He's very much a player's manager. He found a way to use everybody on the roster in some way, shape, or fashion to contribute. Whatever tools that guy brought, he was going to put you in a position to be successful with what you brought to the table. And so Davey was creative with his platoon situations at third base with me and Ray Knight, at shortstop with Rafael Santana. I mean, he would move me around back and forth there pretty freely. And Davey was just very calm and like it was always legit. Like, he always knew where he stood on everything. And I really appreciated that mindset. It was such a different atmosphere than Detroit, but the Mets just seemed to be a younger team with a good mix of veterans that was just really ascending at the same time. And with Doc Gooden, I mean, our Mel Stottlemyre was a pitching coach. He was tremendous. And it just, the whole vibe was very much ascending. Like, we want to win. We know we can win. This is how we're going to do it.
Well, speaking of can win attitude, I mean, in 1986, you're in the World Series. There, you know, game six is such a, you know, a major memory, and everybody's, you know, any baseball fan knows that ball under Bill Buckner's legs. But there was a lot to go into that. Again, you're down in the series. You're on the verge of losing. You know, but again, you have that mentality of, you've been through before. You've been through those wars, and you came out on top. What was the vibe like, you know, from your perspective in game six when you guys are down to your final outs?
Well, I'll tell you what, Pete, the thing about game six in the World Series, we had this attitude that we were never going to quit. We were never going to die, that we were going to be a tough out all the way through. I have to really go back to the playoff series against Houston and that game six, where we were down 3-0 in the last inning, ninth inning on the road. You know, we know the prospects of Mike Scott's going to be out there the next day. And for some way, somehow, we got the job done, you know, starting rallies off, you know, just in weird ways, not giving into the situation, and being able to win that series really gave us confidence that we could continue on and accomplish our goal. So now when you look at game six of the World Series, I was in the dugout standing there next to Lenny, and there's a few guys out there, obviously we're getting ready to hit. And Carter was just going back and forth, grabbing guys by the shirt collar and pulling them in and saying, I'm not going to be the last out of this World Series. I never heard Gary swear once, but he might have swore then. He was pretty intense, and he just kept going down the line, grabbing everybody. Look, he's straight in the eye, man. I'm not going to be the last out of this World Series. And it was almost like he was kind of willing it to happen. And so when I watched his at bat in that game from the dugout, and he was fouling pitches off and fighting and just grinding away to finally get a base hit, I think that lit the spark, man. That lit the spark for that inning, because now all of a sudden you have a guy who's not wanting to quit and was rallying the team to not give up and not just say it's over. Gary gets a base hit, then Mitchell, then Knight, and then Mookie and all that stuff. So it happened so fast, but once that spark was lit, that was really the sign of our team, was that we would take any opening and open that door wide, and we would just like run through the door. And that's what that team did, and we were able to do it then.
Give me the fondest memory. Like, who was the one person that you just loved, like you were closest with on the team? And then after that World Series, like, you two were just like, this is the moment that you guys are able to share, and you've kind of taken that and carried that with you your whole life. Like, that moment was just like amazing. Was there one person in particular you shared that with?
Well, I had a bunch of friends on the, I mean, I loved all my guys on the team, right? They were all brothers. I played cards with Wally, Lenny, all the guys, and we had a lot of fun doing it. But Bobby Ojeda became one of my best friends ever. And he's my best friend. He lives in Jersey, so I see him all the time. I stay at his house frequently, and we talk all the time, and we share ideas about the team and, you know, just different things. And we reminisce a lot about the 86 team and just the years prior to that, even, because he came through Boston. And I faced Bobby. I've known Bobby since I was a high school kid, basically coming out of high school into the Tigers organization. We faced each other many times when he was with Boston in the A-ball. And so there's a picture that I have on my wall, and Bobby's got the same picture. We blew it up. It's nice and big. And I think I'm sitting on his lap. or he's sitting on my lap. I can't picture. We're just like sitting on each other's lap, and we have a beer, and we just got our arms around each other, and we're just like sitting there just thinking about the game and just remembering all the things about the game and what we were able to accomplish, you know, beating Boston. And I know it was a big deal for him because he came from the Red Sox, and when he beat, you know, was able to do that number on them, I know he was like, yeah, he was satisfied. But just going back and thinking about that picture, and I look at it in my wall in my office in Florida, and I look at it, and it says 1,000 words, 10,000 words. And one of these days I'm going to get it. I'm going to take a picture of it and post it on social media so people can see it. It's the greatest picture ever. And to me, Bobby and I, we just share that moment. We share our friendship, and you know, all the guys on the team, we're all close. But Bobby's my guy.
That's awesome. And what you should do is you should maybe this weekend you should recreate that photo, because that'll kill the internet. I'll tell you that much.
That would be sick. I'd love that.
Let me ask you a question, because you know, the funny thing is about your career, especially with the Mets just in general, like, you know, you won two World Series between 84 and then 86, and then you really started to get into your prime from 87 to 91, I mean, you basically, you know, averaged out a 30-30-30 season, which is something that was unheard of, especially for an infielder at that time. I mean, you were unbelievable. What clicked in 87 that kind of took you to a different level?
Well, in 86, after the World Series was over and free agency was starting to kick in, I knew that there was a possibility that Ray Knight was not going to be re-signed and go somewhere else. Frank Cash used to tell me, and Joe McElvain, you know, we got you to take over for Ray, you know, in a couple of years, and this is going to be the plan. Although you don't always expect things to happen the way they say, you know, a lot, just like Bill LaJoy and tell me I'm not going to get traded. So you just have to be ready, you know, for your opportunity. And that in 87, let's see, I came up in 82. So I'd had almost 5 years in the big leagues to that point and felt as a young player that I had enough experience that I could do it every day. I felt like I could do it. When they didn't sign Ray Knight and I became basically the guy at third, Davey said, it's your job to lose. I want you to be my third baseman. And I was like, I'm all in, Skip. I got you. That offseason, I trained like crazy because I knew that, okay, as a player, you have to know your strengths and your weaknesses. I was a natural left-hand hitter. My right-handed hitting was always my weakest spot. I knew that that was going to be the number one thing if I was going to be an everyday player, that late in the ball game, Jim Leland, Whitey, you know, all those guys are going to throw left-handers against me when it really counted in a game. And I have to make right-handed my stroke that was my natural stroke to really feel like, okay, I don't care who's on the mound, I can hit him. I worked my butt off that offseason, and I was able to get to a point where my right-handed hitting felt better than anything. I had so much confidence. My base stealing went to another level. I trained that as well. I trained very, very hard. I hit home runs and I stole bases in the minor leagues. I've always been able to do that. And I just felt like if I became an everyday player and I trained and worked on the things I had to train on and work on and improve on, that I could be a successful everyday guy being a switch hitter. And so I just got way more at bats. And so it was easier for me to kind of settle into a daily role, and success was more, it was easier to achieve, because when you're playing every day, just things kind of happen easier. And so that was my mindset. It was a straight up mindset and hard work. And that's what it was able to do it.
You know, it's funny because you win the World Series in 86. The team is still very, you know, strong. 87, you miss out on the playoffs, but 88, you just miss out on the World Series. Yeah. And then they kind of dip a little bit. The Mets start to dip a little bit. And a lot of people, like you said, Ray Knight didn't come back in 87. Then you had Darryl leave. You had a bunch of, you had Lenny, you had Wally leave. You know, take me through those times. How did that change the chemistry of this team? Because right now, I got to be honest, I'm not sure how much you're watching the Mets baseball. It is a rough season for the 2026 Mets fans. And this was a team that was on the cusp of, you know, Pete Alonso carrying a team, going to the NLCS in 24. And now 2 years removed, where not only are, you know, back-to-back losing seasons, but this is basically the worst team money can buy, part two.
Yeah,
you know. Yeah. So, like, take me through this is very similar times now.
Oh yeah, very similar. So in '88, you got to go back to history with '88 team, and the thing about that team was we had, I mean, obviously Ray left after the World Series, and yeah, that was a blow. I mean, Ray was a leader in the locker room for us, so there was a little bit of a void there. But you know, Keith and we have Darryl. And you had guys that were there willing to take up the slack. So Ray leaves. Things kind of change a little bit in the locker room. Going into 87, we had a good season, but guys were getting hurt. We had all the starters go down with injury at some point for lengths of time. And when you lose pitching, that's going to kill you, number one. In 88, we kind of came back and we rallied. We had a really good team. Added Greg Jeffries. Dave Cohn, you know, we had some guys, right, that could really do the job, and the team was strong. And some people argue that might have been a better team than the 86 team. I've heard that thrown out there. We just ran into a buzzsaw with Hershiser. I mean, that's great starter, gave him innings, complete games, everything, came out of the bullpen. And when you run into that in a short series, that can happen. And that's what happened to us. And things just didn't fall our way. You know, Doc wasn't himself in that series, gave up home run to Socia. T-Bone Shelby, I think, hit a home run as well. I mean, these guys, they never did that test during the year. We beat them 11 out of 12 during the regular season. So we knew how to handle the Dodgers. But when things happen in the playoffs, you just can't control. And then after that, the team started to go through a phase where there was a lot of call to change the roster up and move some guys, and some guys weren't happy and this and that. And next thing you know, Straw's gone. You know, then Lenny goes, Roger goes. There's an influx of players, and all of a sudden you have a, kind of a mismatch of abilities, of tools, what's available. Not, you don't always put the best players together. You got to find the right players that fit together. The right players together can win. The wrong players together, even though they're talented, not going to win. It's hard to put your finger on it, but when you see a locker room start to flip and guys leave and got new guys come in, it's hard to maintain that identity of what you had. And that's kind of what happened to the team after 88 season. You know, guys were just coming and going, and you lose your identity. There's things that you don't have that you used to have. And you fast forward now to 2026, and you look at that and you say, okay, what happened to the Mets from 2 years ago when they were on the cusp of, you know, playing LA, you know, to get to the World Series? And the team has changed. The players have flipped. Last year, unfortunately, sometime in the second half, something was happening inside the locker room. This is my opinion, that changed where the team lost its togetherness. I don't know what it was. I don't know. I can't even guess. But when you have that happen, it's hard to win. You have to win on talent straight on. And it's hard to do that too, because there are teams out there that are playing together and they're winning, and they've got a good locker room. They've got a good chemistry going. And the Mets kind of lost their mojo. And now you fast forward to this year, when you had the guys leave via free agency or trade, now you've lost your identity. And when the team was put together, I think they went out to go get the best players they could, which nobody can fault them for that.
Right.
That's what you want to do. But the chemistry part of it's really taken a hit. And hopefully these young guys that have come up, the Ewings, the Benj, and those guys, hopefully they can kind of like establish their identity. And all of a sudden now the veteran players that they do have will start to feed off of that. That could be a good thing. So you just have to wait and see. But they've kind of lost their way, unfortunately. They've lost their way, and they've got to figure out a way to get it back. But I don't think there's any one thing they can do it. I think it is what it is this year. This is going to be severe growing pains for Met fans to go through. But hopefully, coming out of the season, they'll have an identity and going into next year and where they want to build and how they want to build and who they want to build from and with. And if you can establish that, then I think you have a blueprint.
At what point in time do you look at, like, I'm a Francisco Lindor fan. I think that he's a phenomenal talent. You know, in your opinion, he's getting older, but, like, can they still win around him? Or is it like, oh, he's past his prime, you got to move on from him?
No, I think you could still win with him there. He's not super old. I mean, he's still moving around pretty good. And he's getting hurt a little bit more now than he used to. But what he brings to the table leadership-wise to the infield, I think, is huge. So I would definitely build around Lindor. He can do it. I'm convinced of that. Maybe a few tweaks here and there that he might have to do. I don't know. His workload maybe has to be managed maybe a little bit more, you know, so he doesn't run that injury risk as much. But that is what it is. I would keep Frankie there and try to build around him still. And I like Bo Bichette. I think he brings an edge to the team. It's very difficult to be traded from one league to another and establish right away. It takes time. even though you have interleague play and you've got a, you know, the, he's been to Citi Field before, he's seen the National League clubs, it's still different when you actually make the flip to a different league, and that is your league and your division. So you have to kind of settle in second time through. Hopefully it becomes better. It usually does. And then you go, you kind of prepare for the next season and mentally get ready for that. And if the team can establish their identity this year with those young players and add the, with the older guys that are there, the veteran guys there, I think you got something there. Now it's your pitching staff is where does that go? So that you just don't know yet until the end of the season and see who's healthy and who isn't. But it's a lot to, I know we're jumping forward to the pitching, but when you have young pitchers, you can't depend on them to get you to the promised land. It just doesn't happen that way. These hitters in the big leagues, even though, you know, you can say what you want about them being good or bad, they're very smart. And there's game plans that get developed against them. So they're going to have to figure out a way to beat those guys somehow.
Is that why, like, I mean, the Mets were in the news the other day for using AI to call pitches. Is that the Mets, and it's not just them too, it's other teams, but I mean, maybe they were using a little heavier than others. Is that why they're trying to go a different route to try to, like, okay, we've maxed out on learning potential. These hitters are better. Now we have to go a different level.
Yeah, and you can't blame them. I mean, who wouldn't want to try to get better some way? You know, if you can get AI to come up with a, you know, pitching plan or whatever for, you know, what pitches to throw and stuff in situations, I mean, it's worth looking at. I mean, I'm not opposed to that at all. I mean, if you could use it, I wouldn't lean on it. I wouldn't count on that to make my career, but it's certainly a tool that you can use, and it's worth like looking into a little bit deeper. But I think that's the problem now with technology that's available to pitchers, to hitters, to defenders, everything. I think the problem with that in all sports, period, is if you rely on that to be the backbone of what you're trying to do, you're not going to be successful, because that doesn't take into account what your ability is, what's inside of you, what's driving you, how you feel that certain day. Does your arm a little bit sore that day? Is your legs a little bit sore that day? It doesn't take account into any of that stuff. It's just straight up basic information. And could it work? Yeah, it could work, but you can't just say, okay, it's going to work all the time. You have to always be making your adjustments. That's the part of the game that young players have to learn, that they come up with all these tools and this success and everything, and they're able to showcase it. But the other team is actually scouting you. There's information, there's video, there's analytics that are going to break you down, and they're going to find these holes very quickly. So it's hard. This is the hardest thing for a young player to understand, is your ability got you to the big leagues, what you were able to do physically and mentally. Once you get to the big leagues, it's a whole nother level up. I mean, there's a huge difference between double A in the major leagues. Triple A in the major leagues is a little bit smaller. Triple A, you have a lot of guys with ability, but they're lacking something mentally they haven't figured out yet. So there's a lot of up and down. The big league guys, they've been through the wars. They already understand the ups and the downs. They know how teams are going to pitch them. Once you have a track record against certain pitchers, you know how they're going to pitch you. So you get an idea. If you have success against a guy, that guy knows it. Maybe not the overall game plan can take that into effect. But if I'm facing Greg Maddux, I know what I did off of him, and he knows what I did off of him. So we're always playing a chess match, and you have to figure out ways to beat him. And so, but that's always evolving. It's never settled. And it's hard when you're a young guy to put your brain there, because you're just not used to that. You're just used to dominating with your ability. It's not that way in the big leagues. You have to kind of work your way into that and learn. And I would encourage young players to get as much information from the veterans as they can.
Listen, Howard, one of the Howard Johnson joining me, by the way, one of my favorite things is hearing stories from like a, you know, a pitcher's point of view, but then also the batter's point of view of how they faced each other. I mean, I've heard stories about Maddox, how he used to fool people where it's like, I'm going to throw, it's a blowout game, and I'm throwing an off-speed pitch in a spot that I would never throw you an off-speed pitch, but you think that I'm going to do it right here because, you know, whatever, and then I'll see you in the playoffs and I'll never throw it, but you're waiting for that pitch to come. Never happens. I love that type of stuff. That makes, you know, that gets me going, man.
Yeah, you know, they call it, we used to, the term we call it is exploring hitters. Exploring it. Sandy Alderson's, I mean, Sandy, God, for God's name, Sandy Senior, Alomar.
Oh,
Senior used to talk about it all the time on the bench. We would talk in the locker room with the coaches together. He said, we don't explore hitters enough. And I asked him what he meant by that, and I understood exactly what he was saying, is that the stats may say you have to pitch a guy this way, but this particular pitcher may be able to pitch in that spot. You don't know that. Not every arm is the same. Like not every fastball is the same. Not every slider or split or curveball, it's not the same. It's different from one pitcher to the next. And the stats will show like a heat map of all these different pitches in certain locations. But that takes into account like an aggregate of so many guys. And that's totally different from what a Doc Gooden's curveball is to, like, say, a Ron Darling curveball. Those are two different things. And so when we talk about exploring hitters, as Sandy was saying, that We should throw guys in certain places that maybe we shouldn't, and see how they react to it, because how they react will set up the next pitch. And so instead of just like looking at this is a hot and a cold zone, you know, let's throw one into the hot area every now and then, or let's throw one into that cold zone. Obviously, you're going to see what he does with that. Maybe he hammers that cold zone pitch. You don't know that. That's going to tell you something for the next time. And so you start exploring hitters to find out what they can do, what they can't do. When I was playing towards the end of my career, I remember John Smoltz with the Braves. I was a good fastball hitter, but he used to challenge me with the fastball, but he always challenged me like up in the zone. Most guys would challenge me in or down or away, never really up. And he explored that, and he found out that I had a hard time with that high fastball. Or I was at that time, at least for sure, his high fastball, because he had a lot of ride to it, and I could not get on top of it very well. So he was exploring different ways to use his best pitches. And that's to me, that's what a pitching coach does to a young pitcher. That's what a hitting coach does to a young hitter, is find out, okay, how is this guy pitching you? How can we cover that up so we can turn that into a strength your next time you face him, next time you face that guy? That's how you do it. That's how you build. That's how you learn. And that's the stuff that you want to be happening all through the year, so that by the end of the season, these guys have got like an encyclopedia worth of information about them, right? How does that pitcher, so back in the day, we'd write things down, Pete. We'd write things down each pitch by pitch. This is what he pitched me. This is the location. When I was on first base, this was his time. This was what he did with his move. So you had all this information, how it related to you against him individually. And that was like gold to have that stuff, because now you could see patterns develop and you could start to understand when the other guy was going to do something different. Now you understood it, and it just helped you formulate a game plan for that at bat.
Who is the toughest pitcher that you love to hit off of? There's got to be one. I mean, wow. I've heard stories where, like, I'm buddies with Yan Gomes, played with the Cubs, the Guardians, and I remember we talked about like who he loved to hit off of, and there was one pitcher. I'm blanking on it. It was with the White Sox. I think that was the pitcher, but he was an amazing pitcher. I think it was Chris Sale. I think that's who it was. I think it's Chris Sale. Really? And he's like, oh, dude, I just crushed him. That's the one guy he always got to, you know. But, you know, he's not a Hall of Famer by any means, but Chris Sale is.
Yeah. They used to say, like, Mark Belanger, going way back into the 70s and 80s, he used to own Nolan Ryan, and Belanger was like a 200 hitter. But he owned Nolan Ryan, right?
Yeah.
I used to hit Todd Worrell extremely well. with the Cardinals. He's a reliever. He would dominate against most teams, and most guys. But when I faced him, for some reason, he was throwing where I was swinging. Didn't matter what he threw me, fastball, curveball, split. I was able to get the barrel on the ball and hit it. There was a lot of really good pitchers that I had trouble with that I had to learn how to hit. I'll give you a good story. Doug Drabeck with the Pirates was a really good pitcher, right, from Pittsburgh back in the 80s and the 90s. And he used to get me out on a 2-0 break BP fastball, where basically just take a little bit off his fastball just to get me out front just a little bit. I hit the ball at the end. It'd be a lazy fly ball out to right field or something. And I come back pissed off because he got me out on that stupid pitch. Well, it happened one time at Shea, like the fifth time or sixth time. I'm so stupid. I let it happen that long. Just changed my career. I said, okay, no more. If I'm in that situation again, I'm going to be ready for it. If he throws me that BP fastball, I'm going to wait on it. I'm going to sit on it. And I'm going to take a whack at it and I'm going to hammer it. Sure enough, my next at bat, I go up there, 2-0 count, throws me a BP fastball, took a little bit off. I'm sitting on it. I'm scared to death. I've never done that before. And I hit it out of the ballpark. That changed my career. My eyes were opened at that point that, okay, wow. Now all of a sudden stuff those veteran guys were telling me back in the day made sense to me. And that's how I learned how to hit from that day forward.
That's amazing. This is not supposed to be insulting at all, but like there are edges that people always try to get. Is there something that the Mets, that your teams, the teams that you were on tried to do? Like, I mean, obviously we know the egregious Astro cheating scandal, right? We're not talking about, like, was there something that at your date and time, which now would be like, whatever, no big deal. Was there something that you guys had that was advanced at that moment?
Be honest with you, we did not have any signs given, like during like you have a guy in second and he can see location and pitch or whatever, he can figure it out and relay it to something. The only thing we would do is we would try to set location up and relay that to the hitter. So when you're taking your lead at second base and you see a catcher shift over to one side of the plate or the other, you know, we would just mimic that. So if it was his right hand hitter and the catcher was going to slide into the pitch inside, if we were on second base, we would make our first move, you know, this way towards third base, meaning that the ball was going to head to that half of the plate. And if the catcher set up outside, then we would make a little job move to the left. And that would mean that he's setting up away. So little things like that we did that I think everybody does that, but that's the stuff that we did. Some guys didn't want to know pitches at all.
Yeah,
which is okay.
What were you like? Were you one that was just like, I don't want to know, or if you got information, tell me.
Before the Doug Drabeck at bat, I didn't want to know anything prior. I'm looking fastball. I'm trying to adjust on the breaking ball, the changeup. I'm hunting heater the whole way. Once that happened, I started to realize I could look for certain things, and if I could get something from somebody, I would. But we never really had that. Sophisticated a plan.
Howard, a couple more questions just because I have to. You mentioned guys like Greg Jeffries, you mentioned guys like Kevin Mitchell. Two pointed questions, because Kevin Mitchell got traded early on after the 86 World Series, and there was always a story or like, oh, there was, we all know Doc and Darryl's history. Kevin Mitchell was always wrapped up in that. What's the real true story about Kevin Mitchell? What was he like as a teammate?
The true story, he was one of the best teammates I've ever had. He's like a brother to me. Brother from a different mother, we always call each other. I talk to him on the phone periodically. He's just a great guy. A lot of the stories, Mitch grew up in San Diego in some bad areas. And he had an edge to him. I mean, he would tell you they used to fight all the time. And so he was really an enforcer on our team. If anything happened to any of us out there, we were playing in Cincinnati. I was talking to Straw, and Mitch was right next to me, and we're standing on the railing, and Tuff was up, and he got drilled in the back by Tom Browning, and Mitch is the first one over the fence. He didn't even wait for Tuff to run out there. Tuff's on the ground, like, doing the tuna, and Mitch just hops over the fence and beelines into the pitcher. And next thing you know, there's Straw, and then the rest of us would go out. So it's Mitch is the first guy to come in. He was an enforcer, and we love Mitch. Mitch is the best guy ever. You know, he never let none of that stuff from his childhood or anything affect how he in the locker room. He was always laid back, had a great time, great sense of humor. Unbelievable.
And then as far as Greg Jeffries goes, you named him when he came in. There was a lot. He was a top prospect, someone that was supposed to be the next big thing. And he had his note to WFAN. He spoke about how it was like a hell type of environment. He had a decent career afterwards. He had a couple good seasons with the Cardinals. But, you know, from your perspective, and tell me if I'm wrong here. I hear a lot of – now, I'm not trying to say Greg Jeffries is Juan Soto by any means. But he was to himself, if I'm correct, and that's very much what Juan Soto is. Is that correct of how he was in the locker room?
Yeah, that's fair to say, Pete. That's fair to say. Greg was a great competitor. I mean, this guy would fight you in the box all day long. He wanted to play. He'd fight you every at bat. I loved it. He had a lot going for him. I think he had a hard time with failure. That was his biggest issue. So that's what drives most guys away from success is dealing with the failure that comes with playing. When you get to the big leagues, you could be the greatest player in the minor leagues. When you get to the big leagues, the biggest difference that stands out is not necessarily the pitching, it's the defense. These guys make plays like crazy. I mean, they're getting paid. They're the best in the world to make plays, and they make plays. You hit a ball 9 times out of 10 in your minor league career or balls in the gap, and some center fielder is running full speed and lays out and catches it. That stuff happens. You know, they're positioned better. Everything's better in the major leagues. And I think he had a hard time with the failure that came with that. He came with had a lot of expectations, probably more than anybody I've ever known that had it laid on him, which is very unfair because to have a young player come up and have those kind of expectations is really not a fair shake for him. And I think that kind of hurt his development a little bit because really no matter what he did, if it wasn't the best, he was looked at as struggling. And I don't know how much he read the media, the papers, the radio. I don't know. But I know he was a little bit troubled at times with the guys in the locker room. And, yeah, he went through some difficult times in there. Nothing, you know, evil or anything like that. Just, you know, we expect guys to come in, put their head down and get to work and not worry about the other stuff, you know. And sometimes Greg might have got a little carried away with some of the outside stuff that was going on. But, I don't have any details on that. I just kind of my sense of how the things kind of went down for him. But tremendous player. His attitude, he would play as hard as anybody I've ever seen play. He worked hard. He did all those things. But at the end of the day, if Greg had a good day, you knew it. And if he didn't, you knew it.
Two more quick ones, because again, you've been through this before. 94 was a strike year. We're talking about a potential lockout. Baseball seems to be booming right now. Everyone loves baseball. It's back. There's a lot of good excitement here. There's a lot of amazing ball players, but there's a potential lockout here. Take me through the recovery of baseball. It kind of was at the tail end of your career, but take me through like the outside or your close perspective of it, how long it took for it to come back and a potential strike, a lockout year, what it could the effect it could have on the growth of the sport.
Well, it's definitely going to have an effect. A lot of people, I hear it all the time, you know, they stopped watching baseball after the 94 season because of the strike and stuff and the lockout. And it's fair to say if that happens again, that's going to happen. The only similarity is that some of the people on the owner side are still with the owner side today. There's still a remnant of that in the front offices today, in Major League Baseball front offices today. I'll just leave it at that. And those guys back then really wanted to break the union. And that remnant of that is still in MLB today. You would think that after all this time, baseball and the players would be able to get together and figure out how to not not go down this dark path, right? But as long as that remnant of that is still there, then we're destined to repeat the problem from 94. And that's my heart. I feel, I hope I'm wrong, but I think that's where we're headed. And if that's the case, we're going to lose some fans. I mean, it's sad. I think there's so much money out there to be made, and both sides are making it. Shouldn't be that difficult to come to an agreement. After all, they've had agreements since 94.
Yep.
Correct? So it can be done. The only thing that would stop it from this time being done is that remnant of 94 in the same building now in 2026. So as long as that's there, it's we got a chance to go down the same road.
Well, I hope we don't. And finally for you again, you're back in town for the 1986 celebration, 40 years World Series. Besides Bobby Ojeda, give me the one person you want to see and give a hug that you haven't spoken to in forever.
Oh, man. Well, I see a lot of them. I see a lot of guys. Wow, that's a good – probably Santana. I'll give a hug to Rafi. Mm. I love Rafi. This guy, he had the best – he played baseball the way it should be played. Every day he was the same. He's happy, whether he's in the lineup or not. He was always pulling for you. Even if I was at shortstop or Mitch was at shortstop or somebody else, he was always positive, and he's always joining with the group on the, you know, playing cards and all that stuff. But, you know, I love Rafi. I love Tuff. I love Backman. I see Wally periodically. You know, obviously Bobby O. I mean, Straw. I see Straw. So I see a lot of these guys. Just a lot of good memories, man. A lot of good memories.
Well, listen, Howard, we're looking to see a lot more memories of you. And listen, I'd love to have you on whenever, because I could talk baseball with you forever. So let me know if we could do it again, because I took up way too much of your time. But
that's okay. I like to talk. I like to talk about the game. I'll talk about the Mets, you know?
Let's go. Well, Howard Johnson, thanks so much. Pleasure to finally speak to you. Looking forward to seeing you this weekend, all right?
All right, Pete. Appreciate you, buddy. Thank you.